This is Embodied on the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. With the recent death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and upcoming confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, abortion rights are once again in the national spotlight. But in the debates over legislation and how to define the beginning of life, individual stories can get lost or misconstrued. Today, we're talking about some common misconceptions about who seeks abortions and who provides them. We'll also hear about how abortion laws have shaped the lives of two particular patients who terminated wanted pregnancies for medical reasons. This is a small part of a much larger conversation, so in the time that we have today, we won't be debating the arguments for and against abortion. We'll instead examine the effects of existing abortion laws, how they affect people, particularly those who have a medical need to terminate a pregnancy. Joining me first is Dr. Ratika Nimalendran. She's a family physician in North Carolina who works in reproductive health and joins me now. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me, Anita.
So describe for us what an abortion is medically. Tell us about the procedure.
So an abortion, there are two ways to have an abortion. There's a medication abortion and a procedural abortion. With the medication abortion, a patient will take a pill if they are within the number of weeks available for them to take that pill. And then they'll take a second set of pills, which allows them to pass the pregnancy. This is actually the same process that we use for miscarriage management.
Okay, and the other one is a procedure that they would
right.
have to be done. Yeah.
Yes, and the procedure is done either in a clinic setting or and occasionally in a hospital setting, depending on where the provider is. And it's a very safe and generally fairly quick procedure where we remove the pregnancy from the uterus.
So walk us through what it looks like to access an abortion in North Carolina. We know that things vary state by state. So I'd love to know more about the specific state laws that shape access in our state.
Right. So North Carolina has fairly restrictive abortion laws that put up significant barriers to accessing abortion. These include the 72-hour mandatory delay, the telemedicine ban, and then TRAP laws, which are target the ability for providers to perform and provide abortion care.
So as a provider, walk me through what the experience is like for you. What must you do when you are engaging with a patient? Are there certain things that you have to say, certain types of counseling you go through?
So the patients are also mandated to have a medically unnecessary consent and information given that's provided by the state. This is done prior to me meeting with them and includes inaccurate information and information that's just not true about abortion.
And then once they come and interact with you, what is that experience like?
Right. So for patients who come to see me and who are having a medication abortion, one of the issues is that North Carolina law mandates that I provide and watch the patient swallow the mifepristone, which is the first medication in the pill that they'll take. This is not medically necessary. It's a very safe pill. It does not have side effects. And so, therefore, the patient has to see me face-to-face. And this also goes into that we have a telemedicine ban in North Carolina. So patients have to have the barrier, are already facing barriers to access and having to come to the clinic and to have me watch them, almost like they're a child, take a pill.
So this telemedicine piece has raised a lot of conversation during the coronavirus pandemic when it's harder for folks to get to clinics and people are debating whether you should be able to access an abortion without going to the clinic itself. So I'm curious, kind of as in this bigger conversation, how would you describe what access looks like in our state? Are there a variety of clinics? How prevalent are they? How available is an abortion?
You know, 91% of counties in North Carolina do not have a clinic that provides abortion. And I kind of want to step back just because my experience as a family medicine physician, I provide primary care to patients in our rural community health center. that receives federal funding. And because of federal laws, I'm actually, one, not able to provide abortions to my patients, to the patients that I see who come to me. And additionally, I'm also not even allowed to tell them where they can access an abortion or even access information about what clinics provide abortions. So that's the first, I think, barrier that many patients find, is that their physicians aren't often allowed to even give them that information or give them the care that in other states they can get from their primary care physician.
So how do folks pay for abortions? And do you have a sense of how much they cost in North Carolina?
Yes. So abortion is generally not covered by most insurances, and is, due to the Hyde Amendment, is not covered by federal funds, including Medicaid. So most patients do have to pay out of pocket, and that can be anywhere from about $500 upwards into the thousands to tens of thousands of dollars, depending on their gestational age.
So for you as a provider, what draws you to this work? There are obviously a lot of limitations and a lot of red tape to navigate. Why do you choose to do it?
Right. I knew that if I had the skills, I needed to become an abortion provider from a young age. I identify as a Sri Lankan American, first generation immigrant, and Sri Lanka is a country where abortion is still illegal. And I was raised by a mom who told me about experiences of people she knew who had to go undergo illegal abortions in Sri Lanka in unsafe conditions. People who died, people she knew who died from illegal abortions. And that always sat with me, that this was basic essential health care that people should have access to, that there isn't enough people providing this care. And if I was to become a doctor and have the training, I would want to provide this care for people.
Are there any risks that you assume by choosing to provide this care?
You know, I think there are risks to providing, being an abortion provider, to working in this field. I think we all know and see that there's been violence against abortion providers. I recognize that. I also recognize that this is something that I can do for my community, and that that risk is honestly less than the risk of what a Black man faces just wanting to walk down the street. So yes, there are risks, but they are not going to stop me from providing this care.
So we're in this moment right now where there's a lot of conversation, once again, about legality and how things may change if Roe versus Wade were to be overturned and states were to have more control. How do you think that would shape abortion access in North Carolina in particular?
You know, I think we have to realize that access to abortion is already severely limited, especially to low-income people and people of color. North Carolina does have restrictions, although we do not have a trigger ban like many other states do. A trigger ban is when, if Roe was overturned, immediately abortion would become illegal. My hope is that, you know, there are wonderful abortion advocates, including Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, who have been fighting for years to make sure that we can continue to make sure abortion continues to be legal at the state level. Actually, some of my colleagues through Planned Parenthood recently were part of a lawsuit against the state to try to overturn these unnecessary restrictions that the state has put in place.
We're going to be talking more later this hour about narratives around who gets abortions and why they get them and how popular culture shapes our understanding of it. But from your perspective as a provider, what do you think are some of the common misconceptions about folks who seek abortions?
I think people forget that abortion is common and it's a safe medical procedure. And as you stated earlier, nearly one in four women in the U.S. will have an abortion by the age of 45. That's very common. This is not something that is, rare. And I think it's also important to recognize that the support for abortion access isn't controversial, it's not partisan or divisive, and that 77% of American people support access to safe, legal abortion.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation just ahead, but I want to say goodbye now to Dr. Ratika Nimalendran, a family physician in North Carolina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The heated political debate around abortion can make it hard to have an open conversation about the topic. Prevalent stigma also means that access to personal narratives and factual information can be hard to find. Sometimes the most easily accessible stories come from our popular media, like the new HBO movie Unpregnant.
Hi. Hi. If a young woman needs a procedure, but her parents didn't know, is that possible? Let's say she's 17. Okay. Okay, so not at your facility. Where's the closest place that... There's an Albuquerque in Missouri? Well, sorry, what about, like, Illinois or Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas? No?
With abortion, like many other topics, there is a lot more than what you see on TV. Gretchen Sisson is a research sociologist at Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, a program at the University of California, San Francisco. She studies reproductive decision-making in popular culture. Hey, Gretchen, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So you have this research project that is so interesting. You track all of these representations of abortion on film and television, have this huge catalog, and kind of the big overview takeaway is that characters who get abortions on TV are whiter, younger, and wealthier than their real-life counterparts. I'd love to know a bit more about these trends. Take a cent to them.
Yeah, so our database actually goes back to some of the earliest silent film depictions that we saw of abortion. I think the oldest one is a silent film from 1916. And we've been tracking film and television depictions of abortion stories over the past now over 100 years. So it's very interesting to see how they've changed over time as cultural norms have changed, as the political environment around abortion has changed. And we have found recently that the characters who are considering and choosing abortions on television are younger. And by younger, I mean they're teenagers, not just like a few years younger than what we would expect from an American abortion patient. They are disproportionately white, and they are disproportionately of a higher socioeconomic status than we know real abortion patients are. They're also far less likely to be parenting. So we know that most abortion patients are low income. Most abortion patients already have children that they are parenting. Most abortion patients are in their 20s and 30s. And we don't see those stories told as much on television.
Yeah, the
now,
parenting...
We don't expect...
I was just going to say the parenting statistic was one of the ones that really surprised me the most. About 60% of women who get abortions in real life are already parents, but that really isn't reflected. So talk about why you think that is. Why are there certain storylines that really dominate over others?
I think that the teen pregnancy storyline is really gains traction because teen pregnancy is also so stigmatized to somewhat of a similar degree to abortion. So if you are showing a character who's a teenager, a high schooler, and she's usually set up as having a really promising future, and because teen motherhood is so stigmatized, abortion becomes a more sympathetic or palatable option for a lot of audiences. So we do see those stories disproportionately. Whereas again, that's not what we know the typical patient looks like. And most people are really surprised to find out that the majority of American abortion patients already have children that they're parenting. That's not a story that gets told nearly as often.
Definitely not. And also, it seems like for a long time, representations were really in dramas. They were very dramatized. It was always a really emotionally fraught decision. And I've noticed, at least anecdotally, in movies like Unpregnant recently, it seems like there are more portrayals of people who feel kind of pretty in a pretty straightforward way. They get an abortion, they knew it was the right decision, and they move on. I'm curious about whether that is that because there are more comedies. Are you noticing that storyline appearing more often?
Yes, there are many more comedies in the past 4 or 5 years than we saw before. So in the 90s and early 2000s, abortion stories were almost exclusively on drama programs, a lot on legal and medical dramas that were told from the perspective of a doctor or a lawyer who was somehow involved in an abortion legal case or medical decision, and fewer stories about the actual woman who was making a decision about a pregnancy. Then we transitioned into more stories that were really directly about the women themselves. And then around 2014, with Obvious Child, which was our first kind of film dubbed an abortion rom-com, that sort of changed the tenor of a lot of stories. And since then, we've seen a lot more comedies, either dealing with abortion disclosures, abortion decisions, in less of a heavy-handed, tragic way and more in a matter-of-fact way, and even dealing with some sort of levity or bittersweetness around it, so that it's not quite as fraught of a decision as it could be, which doesn't mean that it's flippant, but it means that we are seeing different types of abortion stories being told that recognize a wider range of emotional experiences around the decision.
Do we tend to see narratives in TV or movies about regret, folks who get an abortion and regret it? And how reflective is that of real life data? Do you know?
So in real life, very, very few women regret their abortion decisions. Some can feel sad about it after the fact while still recognizing that it was the right decision at the time. But even they are a very small minority. So we're talking about, you know, over 95% of women feel very confident in their abortion decisions after the fact. We do see some regret on television. And we saw a lot more of this in past years. Usually you'd have the sort of formula trope was you'd have a character who was trying to make a decision about whether or not to have an abortion. And then someone in that character's life would disclose that they had had an abortion that they felt really sad about for some reason. And I think that that was screenwriters' way of really having, quote, balance to their stories. Particularly if the primary character did end up going through with the abortion. So you definitely see stories about regretted abortions on TV to a greater degree than we would expect to see in real life.
How about barriers to access? I mean, we played that clip at the beginning of the segment from Unpregnant, where you hear the character talking about how she would have to go all the way to Albuquerque to be able to get an abortion without parental consent. I mean, do we see that playing out in a lot of narratives? And does it parallel the existing barriers that are common in around the country?
Yeah, so barriers are still under-portrayed on television, particularly when you take out stories that are like set historically that where the barrier is legality. So when you're talking about the barriers that women face today, they're very dramatically under-portrayed. And part of that is because the biggest barrier that women face in the United States right now in terms of accessing abortion is cost. And you don't see a lot of stories about figuring out how people are, or characters are going to pay for their abortion. But we have seen this sort of new trend of the abortion road trip movie. And it's so funny because, you know, 6 or 7 years ago when I started doing this work, I was like, you could have a buddy comedy with an abortion road trip. And all of a sudden we had Grandma with Lily Tomlin that was a grandmother trying to help her granddaughter get an abortion. And then just this year on HBO, there was Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, which is another what's an abortion bus trip movie about a teen girl from Pennsylvania going to New York City to get an abortion. And then you've had Unpregnant, is exactly this teen girl buddy comedy about a road trip from Missouri to Albuquerque, New Mexico to access the abortion. Now, I think what these movies do a good job of is showing the work that goes into accessing abortion for so many young women. That doesn't necessarily make their portrayal of barriers the most realistic. Both Missouri and Pennsylvania have judicial bypass procedures. They have abortion funds that these girls could have accessed to receive funding for their abortion. So there are more accurate ways of talking about the barriers and how women handle them in real life. But I will say both of these films, these recent films that I'm talking about, are very, very different. One is a drama and one is a comedy. And they're in every way very different except for the plot details. But I do think that what they provide is a deeper conversation about the work women have to do to access abortion right now.
So this brings us to the question that I guess we always ask when we're talking about representation, which is how much does it matter? How much does it really shape how people think about abortion, whether it should be legal, whether it shouldn't? I know you're kind of in the beginning stages of some research about this influence, but what do you know so far?
Well, you know, I always say we, because abortion is so stigmatized in real life, there's a deficit of real abortion stories to contextualize what we think we know about abortion. So everybody knows someone who's had an abortion. They just don't necessarily know that they know someone who's had an abortion because it's so secretive. And in that way, fictional stories can be really powerful exemplars. We've also done some initial data collection looking at how TV plot lines can inform viewers, their knowledge of abortion, as well as what they believe about abortion. We have found that if you include even really small amounts of explicit abortion information from a character with some authority, a doctor character, giving just a 30-second bit of information to a patient about how abortion works, what to expect, what the side effects are, that will increase the audience's knowledge about abortion. In this case, it was a medication abortion plotline. What we don't know is the extent to which increasing people's knowledge about abortion changes how they feel about abortion, their comfort level, their likelihood to provide support to someone in their life who's facing a similar decision or a past disclosure. That's a little trickier.
All right. Gretchen Sisson is a research sociologist at Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, a program at the University of California, San Francisco. Gretchen, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Nearly one in four women will have an abortion by the age of 45. A lot of media and popular culture representations of abortion focus on unplanned pregnancies, like we spoke about. But we hear less about how some wanted pregnancies end in termination and the significance of abortion laws for these individuals. Margaret is a woman in rural North Carolina who terminated a wanted pregnancy in her second trimester due to medical reasons. Margaret joins me now. Margaret, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me and for having this conversation today.
Sure. And before we get deeper into the story, I just want to note that you have chosen to use an alias in place of your real name. Would you mind explaining why you made that choice, why you're concerned about using your real name?
Yeah, it's so unfortunate that has to be the case. But, you know, as y'all have alluded to earlier, there can just be so much blowback professionally and personally if people find out that this is something that is part of your life.
Yeah, well, we've been talking about these popular culture portrayals, and I'm curious for you, I mean, how much did you think about abortion before you were faced with a decision yourself? How much was it on your radar?
I've always been pro-choice if someone were to ask me about it, but it wasn't something that I ever considered very much for myself. It wasn't something that I thought would ever be something that I would have to consider until it was right in front of me.
And your experiences were really emotionally intense and I know really challenging. You have terminated two wanted pregnancies. Could you walk us into, as much as you feel comfortable, what led you to seek those terminations?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have a 5-year-old daughter who is perfectly normal and happy and healthy. When I got pregnant again, everything looked fine. I went to my my anatomy ultrasound and found out that my son had a open neural tube defect, which means that the bottom of his spine did not close properly, and his spinal cord and nerves were completely exposed. And the technical term for that is spina bifida, and it can cause a wide range of disabilities. That people, and people do live with spina bifida, but it can cause a large range of disabilities. After we terminated that pregnancy, it actually happened again, and we had another son that also had an even more severe case of spina bifida, in which we were not given a whole lot of hope. We were given the option to try fetal surgery where they remove the baby and attempt to repair some of the defects. It's an extremely experimental surgery, and we would have had to move to one of the centers for excellence for that, either in Philadelphia or San Francisco, for upwards of a year to even try to pursue it, and we were not even sure we would be a good candidate, and we knew that it would not fix all of the problems that, our sons would have. We also couldn't do that with a 5-year-old child. So that's how we ended up at the place of, terminating those pregnancies that we so absolutely, like you said, desperately wanted.
I know there's so much stigma around talking about abortion generally, and especially talking about it in the second trimester. I'm curious for you, I mean, how did you weigh your own internal dialogue with, in the context of the stigma? Like, what did that feel like for you?
Yeah, it's hard to think about things like that. But what we tried to do was focused on two things: on the individual lives of our sons that we were contemplating, and contemplating what their lives would be like, which all of our indications were that they would not have normal, fulfilling lives. We didn't even know that they would even know that they were alive, in terms of their the amount of disability. The other thing that we kept top of mind was our daughter's life. We knew that, you know, she was already here. She didn't ask for, you know, for any of this. And it was so important to us to keep in mind what her life would look like, what our family's life would look like, you know, with these sort of problems, and how that she would love her brothers, and she would have to spend the rest of her life caring for them physically, and she wouldn't have that sibling connection that we wanted her to have necessarily. So we tried to focus on our son's lives, our daughter's life, and we felt like that we were going to take on the pain of all of that so that they wouldn't have to.
We've talked a bit about access throughout the show. You were living in Eastern North Carolina at the time that you chose to seek termination for these pregnancies. How did where you were geographically shape the options that were available to you?
Yeah, it did hugely. Our first experience with a provider after we found out how severe our son's problems were was absolutely horrific. They didn't even bring up the option of termination. We had to do that ourselves. We had to, we had to find a completely different care system, a completely different hospital that would even give us the ability to discuss what our options were and what we could do that would be the best thing for our family. It was very, very difficult to access that, in the rural part of the state.
We're going to continue our conversation just ahead. Margaret is going to stay with us, and we'll be joined by one other guest telling stories about seeking out abortions for medical reasons, the barriers they faced, and how that all fits into this bigger conversation. So please stay with us just ahead on Embodied. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Abortion is once again a hot topic in the federal government, in discussions about the future of the Supreme Court, as well as in last night's vice presidential debate. Today, we're shedding light on abortion narratives that are left out of larger policy debates and political talking points. This is a small part of a much larger conversation. In the time we have, we're not debating the arguments for and against abortion, but we're examining how existing abortion laws affect those in North Carolina who are choosing to terminate a pregnancy. We're talking with two women who terminated wanted pregnancies for medical reasons, who ran into red tape and judgment. Still with us is Margaret, a woman who sought a termination while living in rural North Carolina. And joining the conversation now is Ruth, a woman who sought a termination for medical reasons while living in New York City. Ruth, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me, and thank you for shedding light on such an important topic during such an important time.
Sure. Thanks for joining us. So I know that you met Margaret at a support group for people who terminated wanted pregnancies for medical reasons. And I'd love to hear more about what you have shared with her, what you two have in common.
Sure. Well, even before I go there, I'd just like to say that it was a struggle to even find a support group for this topic. It's quite easy to look online and find a support group for a miscarriage,
but when looking for a support group for a termination for medical reasons, you oftentimes have to sift through the mud in order to find one. And I was lucky enough to find the one that Margaret and I are both a part of. It's amazing to be able to speak to other women who have gone through similar situations, whether they're in my state or not. We all seem to have very similar feelings on the topic. You know, when you choose to end a wanted pregnancy, it's quite a different feeling than ending a pregnancy you had never planned on having in the first place. And I think that mothers who go through this often don't talk about it because there is a large stigma and a severe amount of shame associated with these decisions, especially for some of those women who already have living children, as Margaret mentioned in her segment.
Yeah. I mean, what was your experience of navigating it within the system? We heard a bit from Margaret about not really being presented with the option for termination, about kind of being immediately referred to surgery. What was your experience navigating it within the medical system?
Sure. So I also lost two babies for medical reasons for two separate diagnoses. My first was for cytomegalovirus. I was, you know, carrying a very large viral load of this particular virus, and our baby was given less than an 18% chance of being born at all. And, you know, after that 18% chance, the numbers just got smaller and smaller and smaller. Like, would we be able to take her home? Would she be able to walk, talk, hear, see, all of these things? The numbers just, you know, began to decrease. And we were told that it was a strike of lightning and, you know, it wouldn't happen again. And then with our second pregnancy, we had a completely different diagnosis of medical issues. So my first time around, I had gone through all the research to try to actually have this baby and see what we could do. And we went to about six of the top specialists in the state to discuss our options. And they kind of all came back to the same conclusion that my viral load was so high that this was really not a pregnancy that we should continue. And at the time I was about 4 months pregnant, and my doctor in Manhattan, she told me to go to the emergency room. And from there I would be admitted to the hospital where we would have the termination. She did warn me that I shouldn't mention that I was there for a termination. And that kind of struck me as odd, as, you know, I live in New York. I don't think of this as really an issue, right? She told me just to tell them I had experienced some bleeding, like, you know, a typical miscarriage symptom, and to proceed to the ER and just tell them I wanted to wait for my doctor. And when we got there, I kind of felt like a thief in the night, like I was hiding something. And I thought, I never felt like I would ever be faced with this kind of scenario, especially not in New York City. Hmm. And when we got there, we were faced with judgment. In particular, one nurse looked at me and he said, "We'll get to the bottom of this." And I felt judged. And I looked at my partner and he said to me, "Did you feel that?" And I said, "Yeah, I did." And from then on, we spent the next 12 hours in waiting in the ER before we were admitted to the OR by this particular nurse. And I can't tell you for sure that that was the reason that we had to wait 12 hours, but I can tell you in my gut that I feel like it was.
Hmm. Well, Margaret, I mean, obviously there's different laws state by state that influence your ability to get this procedure at various points in the pregnancy. In North Carolina, abortion is severely restricted after 20 weeks. So how did that aspect influence your decision, navigating the timing? Is that a challenge?
Yeah, it was a challenge. Our MFM at the time had told us that if we wanted to wait for another amniocentesis, we would have to, and the results, if they were to come back as poorly as we had imagined they would, we would have had to travel out of state in order to receive a termination. And that would have been, you know, a termination after 24 weeks, something like that, along those lines. You would have to go to Colorado, which has, I believe, and I could be wrong here, I believe it's the only facility in the United States where you can receive a medical abortion after 24 weeks of pregnancy. And this was shocking to me because I had no idea that this was even a thing or not an option for me in my particular state.
How about for you, Margaret? How did the timing influence your decision making?
Yeah, absolutely it did. We were trying to gather all the information that we could about our son's condition and what we could do and where we could go. And we wanted to talk to the doctors doing the fetal surgery to see what those outcomes were like. But we also knew in the back of our minds that, you know, if we were going to be able to get this done in North Carolina, we only had until 20 weeks. And it was very difficult to navigate trying to get all of the information that we could in that time frame. Also, my second termination, we found out that our son was very sick the week of Thanksgiving. And we couldn't get anyone on the phone to read us the 72-hour paper. Y'all were referring to that a little bit earlier. The North Carolina legislature has this rule that, you know, you have to wait 72 hours and you have to be read this form about that, you know, you can have your baby, you don't have to end this pregnancy. And we couldn't even get anyone on the phone to read us the paper because people were out of town for the holidays. And it spirals from there, just being able to access the things that you need to access. When you're in a dire situation, that shouldn't be what you're worried about, finding someone to read you a paper. You should be worried about gathering the information that you need to make the best decision for you and your family.
As you both have been exposed to more stories and more narratives through this support group, what have you come to learn about who gets abortions after the first trimester and why, that maybe you didn't know before?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you were alluding to this a little bit earlier, that a lot of people who get abortions are already parents. The vast majority of the women in our support group have other children. Obviously everyone in our support group desperately wanted to have these babies that were medically compromised. It's just not something that most people think about. I think that when a lot of people talk about abortion, they talk about it in a somewhat flippant manner, as if that someone who needs to access an abortion hasn't really thought about it, hasn't really considered it. And I think that that is almost universally untrue. I think that everyone, even more elective abortions than what we're sort of talking about here, I think that everyone thinks this through and considers, you know, the pros and the cons and, you know, what they need to do for their own life and their own family.
Ruth, I mean, what Margaret just brought up, you know, using the term elective is interesting because I know for you, there was a lot of complications with your insurance about whether or not this was an elective procedure and how it would be covered. Talk to us about that experience.
Sure. So actually, this came into play with both of my pregnancies. I would say almost more so with the second, because with my second pregnancy, we were told that our child was incompatible with life. That's a diagnosis that no parent or soon-to-be parent ever wants to hear. But to complicate things further, to then go through a termination and receive a bill from your insurer, for what I received was a $42,000 bill for a procedure that they deemed quote-unquote elective, after a doctor told me that no doctor would agree to, you know, have this child with me in a hospital setting. This was a baby that was incompatible with life. This would endanger my life. And, you know, the baby, you know, was incompatible with life. But for my partner, when he was even heard the fact that my life was at stake, it was sort of like we threw our hands up. How could this be deemed elective? How could I be billed for this as though I were having like plastic surgery, as if it were something that I walked in and planned and wanted?
What has the process been like of navigating this choice within your partnerships and within your families? Maybe let's start with you, Margaret.
Well, I'm very, very lucky and very happy that my husband and I had, we had pretty much the exact same thoughts on this. We had a lot of the same, you know, fears and concerns, but also both felt really strongly that, you know, our sons were going to be better off to not have to deal with all of the horrible medical complications that they were going to have. We were also very, very fortunate to have families who were extremely supportive of our decision, extremely supportive of our choice. And while they were devastated, they were absolutely, absolutely there for us in that. It is a little trickier in terms of friends and colleagues and things like that. Most people don't know, they know that I lost the baby, but they don't know exactly why or what happened. And that's one thing that has been so wonderful about the support group is the ability to look into the eyes of another person who understands exactly what you're talking about and exactly what you've been through. Because most people absolutely cannot. They just can't. They try, but they can't.
Ruth, how about you?
So it's been difficult. My partner and I, like Margaret, we both came to the same conclusion for both of our pregnancies. But then you have to deal with those people around you, those people that knew, your family, your loved ones. I came into a situation where a loved one of mine said, you know, what will you tell people? I think you should tell people that you had a miscarriage. And I just felt very disenfranchised by that statement. I felt like it was playing into this notion of shame and blame that we place on women in society regarding these kinds of terminations. And I guess when I say that, I mean that you're putting miscarriage in this kind of equation that removes the choice, right? And so in that way, it excuses us from judgment in the eyes of these people who suggest that we go on and tell people that we had miscarriages. In my opinion, that's not what happened, right? And in a lot of women's cases that we speak to in our support group, oftentimes these women prayed for miscarriages just to remove that decision from their hands because it is so difficult to really reconcile with at the end of the day. These were pregnancies that we all wanted.
We're in this moment right now where there's a big national conversation happening and looking forward to confirmation hearings coming up soon about the legality of abortion and what may happen in the future. And there aren't many women who have gotten abortions that speak openly about their stories. I wonder, as we close out, maybe if you all could share, you know, what it would take to feel more comfortable sharing your story publicly. You both have chosen to do so on this radio program. But for others, what do you think it would take to create a space where there's more open dialogue? Margaret?
That's hard to say. It does feel like we're in such a political environment right now that it's getting worse instead of better, which is horrifying. You know, my feelings on this are that, you know, if someone else in my shoes were to make a different decision, then I'm great with that. I'm fine with that. I support them. But I don't think that these other people should get to choose for me. I don't think that they should get to make this decision for me and my family. And I think that's what makes it so hard for people to talk about is the judgment and the shame. And but at the same time, I do have to believe, and I feel this in my heart, that if most people knew someone, knew their story, knew about these kinds of things, that I have to believe that most people would say, oh, God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm so sorry that you've had to go through that. And I feel like we're in a political environment where a lot of people don't think about other people and don't think about other people's needs. And so I think that's really the only thing that could help people to feel more comfortable sharing their stories is just a more open environment to discuss it at all.
Ruth, I only have about 20 seconds. I'm so sorry, but if you have any closing thoughts.
I just wanted to say that I think to feel more comfortable, I think women as a whole, we need to feel like our bodies are not
are not the reason that your constituents are lining up to vote for you in an election year. We should not be their, we should not be their soapbox. This is a women's issue. This is a human rights issue. This should not be so politicized the way it has been, especially in 2020.
Margaret and Ruth both joined me today to share their stories. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Kaya Finlay, and Stacia Brown. Elikam Dodor is our intern, Jenny Lawson, our technical director, and Al Widarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.